Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And we are extremely honored today. Our guest is not from inside Texas, but because we feel like good advocacy does not have borders and we can learn a lot from other states, we are very fortunate to have Judge Jeffrey Sutton of the Sixth Circuit joining us today. Judge Sutton, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be with you both.
Before we get started, we always kind of like to let our guests kind of give a little bit of background. With you being on the Sixth Circuit, I know a lot of people know your name, but probably in Texas may not know all that much about you. Can you just kind of tell us a little bit about your background and where you came from?
Yeah, sure. So I live in Columbus, Ohio, practiced at Jones Day for a while. I was the Ohio Solicitor General for a while in the 90s, went to Ohio State Law School, and been on the Sixth Circuit since 2003, so I'm in my 18th year. Before joining Jones Day, I clerked for a couple of years, so I clerked on the Second Circuit, which is New York, Connecticut, Vermont, and then clerked for Justice Powell and Justice Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. And when I was in practice, I was really primarily an appellate lawyer. I mean, it's hard to do that exclusively, but my last 5 years at Jones Day were, you know, in the 75%, 80% category in terms of appellate work. And when it wasn't appellate work, it was usually pretty related, briefing summary judgment motions or dispositive motions. So for me, going to the appellate court wasn't a huge transition. I'd been on the other side of the bench for quite a while, but of course it is a transition to decide and not have a client. So that was, unless your client's the rule of law, which I'd like to think mine is, but not a conventional client and certainly not one that pays me anything more than the same salary every other federal judge gets, which is creates everlasting disappointment.
I really love the idea of a judge's client being the rule of law. It seems like that's a very faithful way of approaching how you attack your duties as a judge.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I do think, you know, if the idea when we take the oath is to be neutral as between rich and poor and whoever is in front of us, what does neutrality mean? And neutrality means honoring what the people have done through their representatives and statutes, what the people have done by ratifying constitutions, and we're just agents of that, and we're not the principal, and the client is the people and what the people have done in law, which is, of course, the rule of law. The thing I might add about that, which had not occurred to me until your comment, Todd, was that it's really helpful for advocates to remember that point. In other words, you do have a conventional client breathing or a corporation or government, whatever it might be. So it's not that you leave that at the door, but it's not a bad idea when you're trying to persuade judges without clients other than the rule of law. Just remember that perspective. I sometimes think when I see our lawyers that are really pushing hard, what's going on is they really, to their credit, really care about their client. Like that's, who can say that's a bad thing? Of course, it's a great thing. The question is what to do with that emotion. And sometimes that emotion gets channeled into higher volume points, talking over judges, kind of a little frenetic attitude about it. And so much better to just remember you're in front of a group of people that are supposed to be neutral as between both of these real breathing clients and do their best to honor the rule of law. And if you pitch the argument the right way, that here's the way the rule of law works, you're going to be speaking our language.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, Litigation Analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with Litigation Analytics on Westlaw Edge. That's a great way to put it. That's kind of a perspective I hadn't really put on that idea, but I really like that as a way to sort of frame both your briefing and your oral argument to the court, you know, and what you're really trying to get to in terms of the result. I love that. Before we kind of move along, you have a kind of unique experience that you got to clerk really for two U.S. Supreme Court justices, which is pretty amazing. How did that work out?
Yeah, so it's unusual. At the time, I was hired by Justice Powell, who was retired. This is 1991 or 92. Retired justices at the U.S. Supreme Court get one law clerk. So I was Justice Powell's law clerk for that year. And the custom at the court is for the clerks for the retired justices to sign on to be the fifth clerk for an active justice's chambers. And it's actually, it had a big effect on my career. I signed on to be Justice Scalia's law clerk. And you might think, oh, well, Jeff, that must be because you were politically conservative, or that must be because you were a textualist or an originalist. And how untrue all of that is. I probably was developing sympathies towards originalism and textualism, but that was not what motivated me. What motivated me is in law school, you know, it's not as if all these judicial opinions you read in law school, I mean, I'm partly responsible for this problem. It's not as if it's inherently fun. I mean, that's why lawyers drink so much coffee. And lo and behold, you're drinking your coffee, you're amped on that, you're trying to get ready for this class, and along comes a Scalia opinion. You don't need coffee for Scalia opinions. And you find yourself smiling, sometimes laughing. And then, of course, his writing is so captivating. So for me, I had two reasons I wanted to work for him. One, he just seemed like a really funny guy. I just thought, what fun to be around someone with such a razor wit and so flinty-minded. And then I really thought, boy, life would be good if I could begin to write even kind of within the same ballpark as the way he writes. And of course, that's a ridiculous goal. But when you're young, you're naive and you think you can do anything. So I really did want to work for him so I could learn to write like him. And of course, that hasn't played out. I mean, but so be it. I think I'm a better writer for it. And the quality of my writing, and this is another thing about Justice Scalia that is so memorable and I'm so grateful for, you couldn't come out of that experience without loving law, including like ERISA cases. I mean, everything was fun. When you were in that chambers, all these cases were fun. He seemed to think every one of them was this epic Marbury versus Madison case, finding the right answer. And so that is so intoxicating. And, you know, maybe, what am I? I'm almost 30 years out from that experience. And maybe one year I'm suddenly going to go, wait, that was crazy. This isn't really that much fun. I'm going to go back to watching sports. But so far, that has not happened. This has been the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, I love law. I enjoy writing opinions. I enjoy looking into them, figuring them out. And I give a lot of credit to Justice Scalia for that.
You may be the first person I've ever heard profess that they really loved even ERISA cases. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that out loud before.
I did say even.
Yeah. Is there a mini Justice Scalia that sits on your shoulder while you're writing or editing your stuff? And do you filter your writing and editing through what you think he would say about what you're doing?
Well, I have a funny story that kind of illustrates that a little bit. Is the viewers can't see this because this is just on audio, but I'm sitting in Justice Scalia's chair, the chair he used at the court. And when he passed, the family said, Jeff, what would you like, his seat or his chair? And I thought, seat, chair, what's the difference? I'll take the chair. That was a big difference. I would have much preferred a seat. The very first day when it arrived and I started working on it, I was working on a case in an area that he would have found really interesting. And I swear I had a couple insights and inspirations. But after that, back to the old run-of-the-mill pedestrian Judge Sutton. So it was very temporary. But the kind of the thing on the shoulder, that metaphor, Justice Scalia is a big presence. And I think all of his clerks, when they're working on hard cases, particularly a difficult move in a case, it's just really easy to hear his voice. And, you know, I found that particularly true when I was practicing in the court, because, of course, he was still there. So I really was thinking about how he would think about it. I think this has a little bit to do with the influence he's had. He had such clear views, clearly articulated views. There's some real value to that in terms of influencing people. It doesn't prove you're always right, and you may alienate people with the clarity of your views, but I think it also improves the influence point because it's just so memorable in its clarity. So yeah, the answer is, Todd, I do think about him quite often.
Well, and before we leave that subject, you were part of putting together kind of the Essential Scalia collection that was published not that long ago.
Yes. Yeah. The Essential Scalia, this is the third book since his passing. My co-editor, actually, it was my co-clerk for Justice Scalia in 91, 92. Ed Whalen, and Ed has been the editor of all three books. The first one was Scalia Speaks, second one, Scalia on Faith. The first one was kind of his speeches on all topics, Scalia on Faith, understandably a faith-related book. And this third one, is the essential Scalia, is his legal writing. So it's got excerpts from articles and books that lay out originalism, textualism, his view of judging and the importance of rules to the rule of law. And then, of course, his writing, legal writings on all these different topics, substantive due process, free speech, administrative law. It was a labor of love. It was a lot of fun to, I thought I knew most of this because I'd read so much of it. And one of the great things about Scalia is you can come back to an opinion you've read three times before and suddenly see something you hadn't seen before, and maybe an appreciation of a way he expressed it or a thought he had that for whatever reason I couldn't appreciate the first or even the second time I read it. Yeah, it's been fun. It's been really fun the last couple months to speak about it. And for what it's worth, I guess this is a broader, this goes back a little bit to the rule of law point. The way I tell my students in law school, no one's going to hire you because you're an originalist or a textualist or a living constitutionalist or a purposivist. That's not how it works. Clients are going to hire you because you speak all the languages of appellate litigation and of constitutional and statutory interpretation. And so what I think is valuable about the essential Scalia is in the state and federal courts, there's a good percentage of people that speak his language, you know, whatever, maybe half, maybe this is the way it breaks down. It's kind of half and half, half are kind of a Brennan-like thing and half are a Scalia-like thing, or let's call it Scalia-Ginsburg is even better. This book, you can read the 300 pages and by the time you're done, you know that language, right? You have to learn the other language, because otherwise you're going to be a really ineffective advocate. But one great thing about this book is if you understand those 300 pages, you know the language. And I think that's valuable. And so it was something Ed and I really enjoyed doing.
It's a great way to think about it, because so often I think people do kind of put themselves in the box of, you know, I'm a textualist, this is the approach. But you really have to think about it more from the decision maker's standpoint of how do they approach it? And are you talking to them in the way that they're going to understand and be able to apply it to the facts of your particular case?
Yeah.
The reason we kind of asked you here originally, and another book that you've put together is the 51 Imperfect Solutions book, which kind of talks about the idea of state-specific constitutional rights versus federal constitutional rights and kind of how those developed. How is that an issue that you got interested in the first place? That's kind of an interesting topic for a federal judge.
Yeah, a great question, Jody. I can deepen the mystery. I've been on the bench now for this is almost 18 years, and I've only had one or two state constitutional claims in 18 years. And each time there were ones where the state courts had already resolved it. So this is not something that my day job directly implicates or directly supports. What happened was I went to Ohio State Law School. No one taught state con law at the time there. Back in the late 80s, almost no one taught state con law, maybe 10, 15 law schools out of 200 in the country. So that was not unusual. What was unusual was my experience as Ohio Solicitor General when I started defending attacks on state laws, several of them under the Ohio Constitution. And as I tell my state con law students, I could teach a semester-long class based exclusively on cases I lost at the Ohio Supreme Court under the Ohio Constitution. So this had this just jarring, head-snapping effect on me. I found myself going, this is so strange. Why is no one talking about this? Why is no one reading it? You know, if you think of the kind of the single story we get about con law in this country, the single story is the U.S. Constitution, where our rights are. The U.S. Supreme Court is the great guardian of these rights. And perhaps Brown versus Board of Education is kind of the way of illustrating how that counter-majoritarian approach works, with the heroes being the U.S. Supreme Court and the federal courts. And I found myself going, wait a second. Each of these cases I was losing in the Ohio Supreme Court under the Ohio Constitution, most of them were cases where the U.S. Supreme Court had already rejected the same claim under the federal Constitution. So I was saying, wait, if you think of liberty and property protection as heroic, why aren't we talking about state courts? And the longer I've been a federal judge, the more I've realized, you know, we federal judges aren't perfect, me in particular. And if you look at the broad sweep of constitutional history, you know, U.S. Supreme Court's made some glaring errors. Buck versus Bell is one of the eugenics movement. That's one of the chapters in the book. Obviously, Dred Scott, Plessy, Korematsu. And so to me, we have this danger of a single story where we think of just one constitution, one court. And the better way to think of it is 51 constitutions, 51 courts, all having good days, bad days. But if we rely on all 51, we hedge our bets and we improve the odds that more rule of law justice is done. The second thing that occurred to me, which this does grow out of my experience as a federal judge, right or wrong about this, I've come to believe that we Americans are putting too much faith in the federal courts as the guardians of liberty and property. And that's, well, it's fun for a federal judge in one sense, because that means we have more power. But the downside is that, you know, the American people, fools though they may be in the short term, they're not fools in the long term. And they have come to appreciate how significant that power is. And what I'm getting worried about is, by relying too much on federal courts and the federal constitution, we're running the risk of politicizing this crown jewel of American government. And so a big theme of 51 Imperfect Solutions is, let's try to use the Brandeis insight of states as laboratories of democracy. And instead of going to state legislatures for our experimentation, or not instead of, in addition to going to state legislatures for our experimentation in dealing with new problems, why not use our 50 state courts and our 50 constitutions, which have all these rights in them? Why not use those state courts as laboratories of constitutional experimentation, at least when it comes to the hardest debates in con law, say substantive due process, what searches are unreasonable, when is it equal protection, or what speech is free? You know, the ones that we really, well, litigate a lot. Why are we just litigating over one constitution in one court, and why not use all 51? Because most people think Brandeis was right about legislation. And what I'm trying to say is it's true for judicial experimentation. Let's have a free market of ideas and experiment one state court after another.
One of the things that I thought was interesting in the book that I think maybe I knew intuitively but don't really think about is the sort of reliance on federal rights as a means to protect rights is kind of a more recent phenomenon, since we really have gotten into the incorporation process, and that state constitutional rights really even predate our federal constitution.
Yeah. Oh, this is so important. And it's such a great example of a huge education gap in this country. Last time there was a poll on this, at least that I'm familiar with, 52% of Americans didn't even know their state had its own constitution. What's amusing about that is, at the same time, we as Americans embrace judicially enforceable rights more than any country in American history. Well, of course, when we say that, we're referring to federal constitutional rights. And guess where every single one of those federal constitutional rights came with? This is not Philadelphia 1787. This is not James Madison's idea in 1791. These are from the first state constitutions written roughly from 1776 before 1787. So the convention in 1787 in Philadelphia was cut and paste. Let's borrow from Massachusetts here, Virginia there, all to the good. In my view, the main innovation in the U.S. Constitution was actually federalism, the very thing we've forgotten. I do find it so funny that on the one hand, we embrace judicially enforceable rights so much, but have forgotten where these exact rights came from. That just seems unfortunate. So part of this is a big education project, which I thank you for supporting with your podcast.
Well, we appreciate it, because it is, Todd may have a very similar experience to me, but I know a number of cases I think about, oh, well, let's make sure that for whatever reason we put in sort of our federal constitutional argument, whether we're in state or federal court. But you don't really think about concurrently bringing the state constitutional argument at the same time, even though, to your point, it may really ultimately prove to be a more protective right, or at least coextensive with the federal right. But it may be that if you convince your state appellate court or state Supreme Court, it could go beyond, well beyond what federal courts would provide necessarily.
Well, I'm assuming a good number of your listeners come from the Republic of Texas. And of all the states in the country, back to calling it a state, you would think Texas would be the one that would take the most pride in its constitution. It's so funny, almost amusing, frankly, to think the Texans of all people would not take pride in their local constitution, and the possibility that that constitution might have a different meaning than the federal constitution, or in some areas be more rights protective. Judge Willett, once on the Texas Supreme Court, now on the Fifth Circuit, had a great decision, a case called Patel. It's about eyebrow threading and basically a right to earn a living. And it was a challenge to a Texas regulation that I think may have required 1,700 hours of education before you get this eyebrow threading license. And I don't know if the court was unanimous, but it was a lopsided decision in validating this regulation and preventing people from earning a living. And Judge Willett writes what's pretty fun concurrence. It has the immortal line, "Don't thread on me." But it's a fun opinion. But one of the things you realize as you're enjoying reading it is the room for different approaches to due process, liberty, a right to earn a living, protections. And if you ask me, it's a very Texas opinion. Both the majority and the Willett concurrence are very Texas opinions and show a little bit of a skepticism of overregulation, a little bit about freedom of earning your own, earning your way and not overregulating that or limiting it. And so, yeah, a big part of doing all this writing is just trying to remind everyone to argue the state claim and then remember it might have a really rich history that's very Texas-based. You know, another way to put this point is the U.S. Supreme Court, well, it can do what it wishes, but it should not, I think we can all agree, customize interpretations of the federal Constitution to account for one demographic group, one region of the country, one perspective. So the Texas, I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court can't write a case about liberty and property that is customized to the Texas history or the Texas experience. That's wrong. That's so unfair to the other 49 states. By contrast, the Texas Supreme Court not only can, it should customize its interpretations of the Texas Constitution to account for Texas history, Texas culture, many epochs of Texas history. And so you have the Texas Supreme Court. It's got a federal claim in front of it and a state claim in front of it. When it's got the federal claim, it can't customize to Texas experiences. It's a national right. But when it has the state claim, it's liberated. And usually that's something lawyers like.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry. And there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. Well, those of us who litigate in our state appellate courts really ought to like it because that's a venue in which we're very much at home. And then as a practical matter, the Supreme Court, where we do a lot of our practice, is the court of last resort on a state constitutional issue.
No appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court on that.
Well, and to keep our Texas connection going, one of the kind of early case studies that you put in your book was about the Rodriguez case and school finance in Texas. And I thought that was an interesting example because it really does sort of drive your point home about how you may find a state court far more protective of a right than a federal court would be.
Yeah. So just so everyone, I think probably everyone does know this story on the podcast, but the Rodriguez, of course, came from San Antonio. So it's about poor property areas and higher wealth property areas within the San Antonio city and suburbs. And famously, in a very close decision by a 5-4 vote, the court refused to grant relief under the Federal Equal Protection Clause. But eventually, in the Edgewood cases, the Texas Supreme Court eventually, about 10 years later, granted that same relief, maybe 6 years later, granted that same relief under the Texas Constitution. And so, yeah, I mean, who are the heroes of that story when it comes to equality of educational opportunity? Going back to practice point, Todd, I wanted to say this in response to your point that just this is just a pure practice tip. So let's say you've got a case and you're either on the defense side or you're bringing the claim. And if you're bringing the claim, you add the federal and state constitution. If you're on the other side, maybe you find a way to bring the Texas Constitution into it if you can. That won't always be true, but sometimes it is. Why might preserving a claim about the Texas Constitution be valuable to you? And here's my reason. Am I right in remembering that the Texas Supreme Court, a lot of its cases are discretionary review cases?
100%.
Yeah. So one of the problems I can remember, I lost a lot of cases. I think I've already mentioned that. One of the hard things about getting a case into a discretionary high court is how do you show it's important? Like how, because you think it's important, but that's because you lost and your client's angry. You don't have a lot of credibility when you tell the higher court how important this case is. They're like, Jeff, we know what's up. You're just, your client's unhappy. They're probably unhappy with you and you're trying to save face and turn this defeat into a victory. So your credibility level is not high in convincing the high court to spend its limited resources on your case. What is a very attractive way to get the court interested? Separate question presented. Does the Texas Due Process Clause, does the Texas Free Speech Clause, does the Texas Free Exercise Clause have a different meaning from the its federal counterpart? That is ding, 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 very shiny object when it comes to any high court in this country. And then if in your argument, you show that this claim is rooted in like different language in the Texas Constitution, an interesting history, I'm just telling you that I have spoken to almost every set of state court judges in the country over the last 3 years, and I've yet to come across any that wouldn't be super intrigued by that point, which leads to one related point. People are always saying, okay, Jeff, you've read all these state cases about state constitutions. Like, what's the common denominator that links the cases where the state courts charted their own path and granted relief, particularly where the federal courts did not grant relief? It's not textualism versus non-textualism, originalism versus living constitutionalism. It's not liberal conservative. It's not Republican appointed, Democratic appointed. It's not elected, non-elected. The key common denominator is local pride. All high court judges in the country today, and I'm going to bet from the beginning, have always shown considerable pride in their own constitution and the ways in which that constitution is rooted in that state's experience. I mean, think about it, particularly if you're an elected judge. But even if you're not an elected judge, what state high court judge would not be interested in Texas history or Ohio history and where these guarantees came from? So it does require some work sometimes for the advocate, but hey, we just described a situation where you lost. So maybe you owe your client some work, maybe even pro bono at this point, you did lose. And find that local story. I can't say this with more conviction. State court judges love their states. They love their state constitution, and they're just looking for someone to show them that there's a story to tell that no one's told yet, or maybe it's just not that complicated a story. It just needs to be told in this case.
You hit that point a little bit earlier when you mentioned the Republic of Texas. Of course, our state judiciary has a lot of pride. And of course, we have a great amount of interest and pride in our state constitution. But as we've talked about on the show before, it is really rather surprising how undeveloped our state constitutional law is. And we can comment and kind of like go off track talking about how disorganized our state constitution is and it's sort of piecemeal. But it's a great point. I mean, talk about an opportunity for advocacy. And that's an excellent, very practical tip to bring forward on the show, Judge. Thanks for bringing that up.
Well, you know, one thing I'm often asked, I mentioned the election point, which generates a lot of reactions in people in terms of the judging you get from an elected judiciary. And I must confess, I started out as someone quite skeptical of electing judges. You know, why use a majoritarian process for a non-majoritarian job? But then I went through the federal selection process and I found it to be highly political, not very attractive. And I found myself thinking, I think we're picking from a bunch of really bad options here. So be careful before you get on a high horse about one being better than the other. But, you know, the good advocate takes the world as it is in front of them. And instead of complaining about it, finds a way to have it work for them. So let's think about why elected judges are good on this topic. And the way to illustrate the point is a reason that state courts sometimes don't have a very developed state con law is because they've had this temptation, this presumption that whatever the federal constitution says presumptively is what the state constitution should mean. Probably because it's probably an education issue, right? That everyone's studying federal con law, that's the language of con law that they know. So if it's the language you know, it's the language you resort to, unless the advocate gives you a really good explanation. So answer one is give them the explanation and then they'll be happy to accept it. But answer number two is just think for a second how easy this should be. Think if I ran for the Texas General Assembly, the Texas legislature, and got up on a stump speech and said, you know, whenever I have a really difficult problem of Texas policy, I always ask myself, what would Congress do? You can't get away with that. That is not a plausible answer. In fact, I would say that's an answer that would destroy any political career at any point in Texas history. And I would say the same is true for the other 49 states. Well, think about what that says about elected judges. They can't possibly think that the people of Texas think about it any differently. I mean, what state doesn't have local pride over its capacity to fix local problems? And what group of people really does think the folks in Washington have better, superior answers? I certainly wouldn't have thought Texas was the place to find that attitude. And so that's what you have to convince the state court judge is going on when the other side says, just follow the federal model. The federal model probably is helping the other side in that case. Otherwise, they wouldn't be pushing the point. But it's a very funny thing for an elected person to accept. It just doesn't seem that hard to me to push back on.
That makes a lot of sense. And there really are some downsides, having read through your book now, that you don't necessarily think about at first blush of focusing on federal rights. You use the phrase federalism discount. And I love that term because I think that kind of sums up what some of the big problems are.
Yeah. No, I think so. One thing about the U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, we tend to think of it as liberal conservative. We have all these dichotomies. Even in the Warren Court, which was a pretty innovative court, developed a lot of new federal con law, you still realize you're sitting as a high court for a whole country. It's a pretty diverse country. And I would say today's court is maybe even more sensitive to that point. In other words, they're just much more likely to appreciate that that's a pretty complicated issue. And it's possible the people of Texas might think about it differently from the people of Massachusetts. And maybe our federalist system should account for that and allow those different approaches. That of course, is the federalism discount. That's allowing local innovation over an issue about search and seizure, property takings, free exercise, you name it. And I, you know, well, illustrated, not with a Texas issue, but I think it's a nice illustration. Think about free exercise of religion issues, which are, you know, that's pretty hot topic right now, I would say, throughout the country. And, you know, think of states like Utah, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, Maryland. They were founded by religious dissenters, different religions, but religious dissenters, a group that was unhappy as a minority faith in another colony state. And one reason to found this new state was to either be in the majority or at least not have their faith discriminated against. Well, surely the state high courts in those four states can account for that history. And that's the federalism discount. They're allowed to let these four states chart a more faith protective environment because they have a lesson in history where they knew what it was like to be a dissenting voice on matters of faith. And so that seems to me, yeah, I think the federalism discount is a nice way to think about it.
What are kind of tips or considerations that you would give attorneys that maybe they need to start thinking about when they're going to address these issues in court? And I think you've already given some, but just kind of how to frame that analysis and ways that they can present these better.
Yeah. Well, I've been thinking about a lot. I mean, one great thing about talking to a lot of people about 51 imperfect solutions was not so much the chance to tell them what I thought, but to learn from so many different people around the country and hear their perspectives and other ideas. And so I'm now, believe it or not, have another book coming out on this, which is going to be about structure, not just, well, it's going to be about rights too, but mainly structure. And one thing that just occurred to me is how a really, really great way to think of clever arguments under state constitutions is oddly enough to remember your class on federal con law. What is a class about federal con law, really? Well, I have a slight bias in this as a federal judge, so forgive me my bias, but let me just tell you what I think it really amounts to. The professor assigns an opinion by Judge Sutton. They start out class by warming up, and student A presents the facts when it comes to Judge Sutton's opinion. It gets a little more complicated with student B, who's asked about what the holding of the case is, and sometimes we know there's room for debate about that. But then students see through the rest of the alphabet, we start getting into, what do you think of Judge Sutton's reasoning? Probably getting a sense for my sensitivity on the topic. I'm never there for these discussions. And I'm generalizing a little bit with a twinkle in my eye that quite often the point of a class in federal con law is to teach all that has gone wrong with federal decisions in con law by people like Judge Sutton. I mean, of course, it's partly a critical thinking exercise is going on, but you know, it's hard to take away from a federal con law class anything other than the message that there's an awful lot of tricky issues, if not serious problems, with federal con law. So my advice to the lawyer trying to make a state con law argument is to go back and remember every one of these criticisms of federal con law. That's not hard to find. I mean, the law reviews are filled with criticisms of federal con law. There must be hundreds of books about all the problems with federal con law, whether in creating more rights or that we should create fewer rights. It doesn't matter which way it goes. The point is, there's no shortage of criticism about things that have not worked out well in federal con law. Think about tiers of review. I mean, one scholar said we now have 7 tiers of review. I mean, you have to love the kind of biblical connotation. Day one, God gave us rational basis. On day two, God gave us strict scrutiny. On day three, God gave us intermediate scrutiny, all the way to day 7. But once you get outside of that, you have to ask yourself, if we got 7 tiers of review, we seem to be a case away from 8. Maybe tiers of review haven't worked out as well as you might like. And it's the rare federal con law professor teaching a class in equal protection who doesn't articulate some of the weaknesses of tiers of review. Well, if tiers of review does not help your client in a Texas case in challenging a Texas law or regulation, you have a lot more ammunition than you realize when it comes to explaining why the Texas Constitution's equal protection guarantees might try a different path. In the book, the Buck versus Bell story talks about the 19th century approach to this issue using class legislation. Well, that was the phrase they used. And I've gone back and looked at that. There's some really good insights. I don't think it fixes every problem. But in the federal Buck versus Bell case, the court was beginning to use tiers of review. Rational basis was the first one. And the state courts who got those cases right, from my perspective, used class legislation. So, you know, it illustrates it might not be a terrible doctrine, and at least it's one you shouldn't ignore.
And just as you were mentioning that, that kind of occurred to me, it is a lot easier from a political standpoint to have a political fix of an issue in a state if the state legislature feels like they got it wrong than to get Congress to fix an issue that may or may not come out in favor of 50 different states. It sure is easier to get a local redress on the legislation side of something too.
It's a smaller state, probably a little more homogenous sets of views, right? They're all in the same state. But my real thing about that is compromise is so much easier at the local level. It is so much easier to get two sides fighting over an issue if they're from the same state, because if the compromise works out, you develop trust for the next time something comes about. And how do you develop compromise in the Texas legislature if all the compromising or power is in the national legislature? It's been taken out from under you. So yeah, I quite agree with that point. It doesn't mean you don't nationalize some things, but that's the Brandeis point, is don't nationalize prematurely, because you might pick a bad choice and it can hurt an awful lot of people when you experiment on the whole country at once.
Well, and as Texas's constitution proves, it's certainly easier to amend a state constitution, generally speaking, than it is to get the federal constitution to do anything. Maybe too easy in some states like Texas, but
yeah, well, this second book I have makes the point that the federal one is probably too hard and the states are too easy, is my view. But you know, the sin of easy amendability is, you have to ask yourself, how much of a sin is that? Because I mean, it is allowing the people to respond to something they don't like, and they can change it because it's 51%. I mean, the problem with the 3/4 requirement at the federal level is it's basically impossible to amend the Constitution to deal with a controversial issue. And that's probably not been healthy.
On the kind of subject of systemic changes, I think that there are a lot of things advocates can do, but your book also kind of talks about things that courts and state bars and all that can do to sort of bring these arguments to the forefront and make them easier to do. Could you kind of address a few of those? Because I thought that those were some insightful things to think about too on the other side of this.
Yeah, you know, one state that's done a really good job on state constitutional law is Oregon. And some judges and practitioners, they've got like a 500-page book that they give out to people when they become members of the bar that lay out the different parts of the Oregon Constitution that have been given independent meaning. It's really just an educational resource is what the point is. It's obviously local pride point, but the real one is that it's a resource. I kind of like that idea. That seems useful to me. Another one that seems useful to me as a kind of a local rule, whether Texas Supreme Court or local court, is to have in the rules that if you choose to bring claims under the Texas and the U.S. Constitution, you've got to brief them in separate headings. Because this helps break free from this temptation to let the federal language, the federal constitutional doctrine, dominate the local conversation, which is what has been a big problem in state con law. So, and then the other thing I would recommend is that they say, if you're going to bring a dual claim case, always brief the state claim first, because that again takes you away from the gravitational pull of the federal doctrine and forces you to look at the language of the Texas Constitution, its history, Texas cases. So those, and the other thing about putting those in the rules, just by seeing them, it's educational, right? The lawyer's like, ooh, wow, that's, hadn't thought about that. You know, I always tell people, just read Article 1 of your Constitution. I mean, it's Article 1 is on almost every state constitution is where the rights are, Declaration of Rights, Bill of Rights. Pretty sure that's true in Texas. And it's so much longer than the Bill of Rights. In every case, the rights are often much more specifically articulated. They're sometimes very general, but much less often. So when you see it, you suddenly go, wow, this is just a different set of guarantees. And it often is, can be idea generating and quite helpful.
Texas Article 1 definitely has a long list.
Yeah, no, I've looked at it before.
That's an interesting point about a rule change, you know, requiring the state constitutional issue to be addressed first. I don't know how widespread that idea might ultimately become, but it does seem like a great practical tip for an advocate to take away from this conversation, which is, if you don't want to get your state constitutional argument to get lost or sucked into the gravitational pull, as you say, of the federal issue, then give it its own treatment. Make it Roman numeral one in your argument instead of burying it later, federal constitutional argument. I really, really like the thinking behind that. I think that's one useful way of framing this issue from an advocacy perspective.
It's quite consistent with a bunch of other canons that we all accept quite readily. We always make a statutory before a constitutional argument because the statutory argument is less consequential than the constitutional one. So why wouldn't we use the constitution that's less consequential than the national one, right? I mean, that just makes sense to me. If you had a Texas statutory argument and a federal statutory argument, surely you'd start with the Texas statutory argument if it's potentially case dispositive, because it's asking for the smaller ruling. I mean, the normal thing is to do less rather than more. And so this is a less rather than more point. And I don't know, it makes sense. And I think it's true whether you're in state or federal court. But yeah, it's very funny in state court to think you start with the federal constitution. That just seems funny. Why would you start with the constitution of another sovereign when you're in a state court? Why not start with the state constitution?
Almost picture in my mind a Venn diagram, or maybe not even a Venn, but concentric circles, right?
You know, yeah, or decision tree. All those work. Yeah, all those work. Decision tree, yeah. Just, I think the usual decision tree of organizing arguments is you start with the smaller source of authority and you work out. And that seems to be true for statutes, constitutions, local ordinances, you name it. And why not stick with that?
I also really like the idea, and you mentioned it, of just teaching state constitutional law in law school. I don't believe that was an option when I was in law school. If it was, I definitely missed out on that. That does seem like something that's probably a little bit underutilized in legal education because it is so wrapped up in federal constitutional law.
You might be amused to hear that I, of course, agree with you, and consistent with that belief with COVID, we're all looking for silver linings. And one is that I'm able to teach at about 5 or 6 law schools this year, state con law. So I feel like Johnny Appleseed, dropping apple seeds everywhere on this little topic of ours. Yeah, it's easier to have a Zoom class. You don't have to go anywhere. And of course, most law schools aren't based in Columbus, Ohio. So it's good for me.
What a great opportunity.
Our podcast kind of developed right at the start of COVID, and we've managed to now find so many guests who probably wouldn't have done it on Zoom years ago, but now everybody he knows how to Zoom. It really is great to be able to bring people together.
I agree. Agree with that.
Well, we're kind of getting towards the end of the time, but we always like to leave our guests some room at the end to give some tips or a war story or something. And we want to be respectful of your time. But if you have any other even more general tips for advocacy or a good war story you'd like to share, we'd love to hear that.
Yeah, I'll give one war story, which now happens to be a tip. The group listening to this podcast does not need my help in knowing that it's really important for your clients to strategize who the final decision maker is. All right, so you've got a case, you've got to go to court. Let's say for the sake of argument, it's a constitutional case. You got to think, do I want this ending in the Texas Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court? That's like good strategic thinking. That's what you're supposed to do. There's nothing wrong with it. And you size up where the two courts are and you ask yourself, where would you rather be? And when I was doing the vouchers case in Ohio, to their credit, the challengers to the Ohio voucher program relied a lot on state con law. And that was wise because at that time, the Ohio Supreme Court was probably a better place for a challenge to a vouchers law than the U.S. Supreme Court was. So I was very nervous about that because I thought the Ohio Supreme Court would probably rule, just say the state establishment clause, not address the federal establishment clause. And as Todd pointed out, that means I couldn't appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Sometimes, though, you state constitutions and federal constitutions can interact. And sometimes a state constitutional guarantee will actually violate a federal constitutional guarantee. So what I did in the vouchers case was I raised a federal free exercise defense. I said, if you construe the Ohio Establishment Clause to prohibit vouchers from being used at faith-based schools, you're discriminating against people based on faith in violation of the federal free exercise clause. So that meant no matter what they did on the state establishment clause, it would have a federal component to it. So I didn't end up having to use that because I lost on another ground. I lost on the ground of it being a single subject problem. And so we went back to the legislature and they had to repass it in a single bill. But I think the war story there, the point there is, and we're actually seeing this in the election litigation. Sometimes state constitutional rulings, even state statutory rulings, but quite often state constitutional rulings can implicate another federal guarantee. And so in the election litigation, the question raised is, does the federal constitution's Article 1 and Article 2 provision that the state legislatures will decide election laws, does that limit in some way state court decisions about election laws? So it's really tricky, no definitive answer. So the point is that I guess the practice tip point is sometimes the two sets of constitutions interact and you don't want to lose sight of that either.
Well, that's an interesting point, Judge. And we've really enjoyed having you on the show, Judge Sutton.
Absolutely.
It's really given us a lot to think about, I think, in terms of how to go about state constitutional issues. And there's an abundant opportunity to bring those issues to the forefront in cases here in Texas. So hopefully we'll encourage folks to give that a closer look. I also want to tell you thank you for adding at least two, maybe three books to my reading list just by listening to what you've been talking about, because these are all just super fascinating subjects. And I'll just mention that I really like the fact that the cover art of 51 Imperfect Solutions features Texas at the dead center of the graphic. So your mind is in the right place when it comes
to... What you don't know is that it's a little like Sports Illustrated. All the sales of the book in Texas put Texas in the middle. All the sales of the book in Ohio put Ohio in the middle. No, I'm joking. Yeah. No, I love Texas. Love Texas.
That would be brilliant if it were so.
Hey, well, listen, my pleasure. I really enjoyed talking to you guys. Good luck with the podcast, and I hope our paths cross again.
Well, thank you. We do too.
Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@texapplawpod.com, message us on Twitter or Instagram at texapplawpod, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at @texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.